You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Good afternoon. Welcome to Every Voice Matters. I'm Dori Francis. Sorry about the little hiccup on last week's show. My guest actually called into court to make an adjustment, but we're back on track this week with Anthony Bresciante, who is the franchise owner and operator of Sit Means Sit in Denver, Colorado. I'm actually coming to you today from Utah, as I've been traveling for the last couple weeks. Anthony has over 17 years in the work that he's been doing, and he's worked with thousands of dogs, trained thousands of dogs, including mine, Aspen. And he's earned a broad spectrum of experience and just loves what he does, which you can tell. So welcome, Anthony. Glad to have you with us today.
Thanks, Dori. I appreciate being invited. Thank you.
You have a wife and two daughters there in Colorado. And besides your wonderful passion for dog training, you also enjoy the Colorado, you know, adventures of biking and skiing and barbecue times and family times. And plus you have your own dogs, obviously, which you get to enjoy as well. We have so many questions that came in. I'm not sure we're going to get through them all. We may have to have you back again, but we'll definitely just get as many of them answered as we can today for people who are listening and people who will listen later. Why don't you start off, Anthony, and just tell us a little bit about, you know, when you began this adventure?
Sure. Thanks. Almost now 18 years ago, two things were happening in my life. I was looking for a career change. And at the same time, I had a great dog named Jasper, who was about 4 years old. And I was raking leaves. He was chewing a stick. He spotted a coyote and he bolted across a really busy road here in Denver. And I felt sort of out of control. And I called a guy that I knew, a man named Dave Skoletsky, and started working with Dave on my own dog. And within a week, I said, "Do you need any help?" And he said, "No." And that was almost 18 years ago.
Wow.
I just never left. I fell in love with sort of the idea of training and having better control, because ultimately, like I said, I felt out of control in that moment. Jasper was at a big risk running across that road. And I knew I just needed to do something a little different to make sure I could keep him safe and still have the fun we wanted.
So Sit Means Sit is actually located in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, correct?
Correct. And we bought a building a few years back.
Yep. And, you know, what are all the different types of services that you offer?
So from a bigger view, Sit Means Sit has over 140 locations across the country. We're the largest U.S.-based dog training company in the world. And all that really means is we've established some degree of results and success. But I do own our what's called Denver location. We find a building here in Wheat Ridge. Here, what we do is everything we do has a private training element. So we are one-on-one with people and their dogs. Some of our programs are limited. Some of them are actually unlimited for the life of the dog. And then we do programs where we might be working, again, a lot with the owners and the dogs. They come and go. We have a program where you can drop the dog in the morning. We work with them all day and then do your lesson in the evening. And they go through a series of several weeks. And then we also have board and train programs where we actually take and keep the dogs here with us for a period of time to jumpstart their training and fundamentals. And then we bring in their owners, of course, and kind of owner transfer all that information and technique and things you need to know how to train as you live with your dogs. And because of the lifetime support, ultimately we're helping to, as best we can, guarantee a result.
And so you can come back for tune-ups, which is what I'll be doing soon.
Right. Yeah. You know, because life changes, right? Everything evolves, whether you have kids or you get another dog, or 3 years from today, you get a neighbor that came in with three dogs and makes your dog crazy. You know, we adapt in those moments, the game plan for understanding how to get through these new changes. And so that's one of the reasons that I personally in our Denver location have decided to simply offer lifetime training. A lot of our locations don't do that, but they're certainly supportive. And I've just chosen one path that seems to work.
Well, let's get to some of these questions that came in. Most of them are all from Colorado residents. We have a couple from out of state. So Elena says, can you train an aggressive German Shepherd dog?
Yes, very frequently, in fact. German Shepherds, you know, let's think of it this way, okay? And no, because there were a lot of questions that were similar. What about my terrier?
Yes.
What about my beagle?
Right.
What about this?
Right.
What about that?
Well, I tried to get them to share what kind of dog that they have, just so it could, and you know.
Yeah, no, I love it. Yeah, I love it. And here's the thing, though. Dogs are dogs, right? And so what that means is that fundamentally, if you can get their attention, you can teach them the skills that they need, or you need, to control their impulses and energy. So if you said to me, Anthony, what's your philosophy? I'd say, that's our philosophy. It's our job to teach them the skill to control their impulses and energy on demand. Meaning normally you can run and jump and bark and dig and act like a dog, but on demand, we need to be able to have the skills, which is all obedience, to control the impulse and energy. It kind of doesn't, in a lot of cases, matter what the impulse and energy is. Some of us are gregarious and outgoing. Some are submissive or anxious. Some are territorial or dominant. It's one of the reasons that our CEO named us Sit Means Sit. Because if you're happy, sit. If you want to kill that mailman, sit. If you're nervous and would like to run away from something, sit. Because ultimately, you're talking about building a skill to keep the dog safe. And then from those skills, right, now you need some exposure and repetition in an environment until eventually maybe the reactivity to something just doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
For instance, people that live near the airport, over time, they don't really hear the airplanes the way they did in the beginning when they first moved in. Okay, so let's take our German Shepherd as an example. You know, characteristically, they are often, most often, true to their genetics that they want to guard and set boundaries. And that's fair, but you and I, like an alarm system, want to be able to turn them off. And then I don't teach off, no, leave it, stop. I teach what we want. Come, sit, go to your place or your spot, right? So we have a more, if you will, positive approach toward developing the skills and habits that we'd like them to have, instead of saying stop it, which doesn't really usually change the energy. I have kids. I can say stop it 1,000 times. I go, sweetheart, you come over here and you go over there, right? And so we tend to direct what we want and then again, develop those habits and expose them until maybe over time their brain says, okay, I see what you want and I don't have to overreact.
So Emily and Aurora, kind of around the same thing, you know, can you train a hyperactive bulldog?
Sure, comes to the same idea. You know, it's about focus and about being able to maintain attention through distractions, right? I mean, that's really the key. So when the doorbell rings, one of the questions was about doorbells, in fact,
right?
That's a distraction. Yeah. That's an exciting moment. And our job remains the same. You know, let's just tell the dog what we want. Come, even though I know you want to stand there barking, just come to me, right? Or just sit and do these things we need you to do, so that we can manage those expectations or those moments
that they have. Yeah.
Correct.
Eileen says, could you give an example from a past experience where you restrained an aggressive dog proficiently?
Yeah, we have a lot of experience, unfortunately or fortunately, with aggressive dogs. And, you know, again, going back to allowing or having their focus. There are some obviously techniques around, for instance, what we call double lining or double leashing a dog, so that we could have, for instance, one person holding a leash and then the other person holding a leash that the dog can't get to either of us. Sometimes I'll do that with a carabiner on the wall, and then I'm able to move the dogs or kind of teach them to sit, teach them to move to a place, but using those leashes that they can separate from us. We obviously also use muzzles at times. And a muzzle, you know, for a lot of people is sort of frightening. Oh my gosh, does my dog need a muzzle? In my world, it's no different than saying, oh my gosh, does my kid need training wheels? Right? If that tool allows the opportunity to grow and learn and then take the tool away, right? Then fantastic.
That makes
oftentimes,
sense.
Yeah, oftentimes the muzzle simply changes the dog's psychology. You no longer have your mouth to use in your conversation. So let's use your brain, right? Or let's stop reacting and start finding other ways to respond.
Okay. You know, and we had talked a little bit about, you know, COVID and how many hundreds, probably thousands of people got dogs during COVID. A lot of, I know the shelters actually ran out of dogs. People were adopting them like crazy. When we used to go to the dog park, we saw multitude of, you know, new puppies and older dogs actually quit going to the dog park because so many of them had zero training. And, you know, what do you think is happening now as people are starting to either go back to work or have a different schedule? And now all these dogs have, you know, just really been sticking close to home, close to their, you know, their owner, and they're going to have a schedule change here coming up really quick.
Yeah, absolutely. What we're seeing is as things have opened up, some people are returning to work, not always full time, but they're returning a few days a week.
Right.
People are starting to get back to a restaurant or a movie or a concert, and suddenly the dogs say, what's happening here? You know, you're supposed to be here all the time. And you know, there's a lot of intimacy that you share with your pets, as of course we want to, but that
separation
in any relationship, right? Yeah, in any relationship, Dory, when you have a certain level of intimacy, right? If you're not careful, it can undermine respect or authority. For instance, my kids will yell at me, but they would never yell at you. There's a safety and security in the intimacy, but it can undermine sometimes respect and authority. So what we have to do is find the balance in our, what we refer to as culture, for instance, of living at home, of sharing intimacy, affection, love, relationship, right? And balance that out with structure and rules and expectations. And, you know, ultimately we have to teach the dogs how to be okay without us there at all these times. And of course, a lot of social cues, you know, for a lot of people and their dogs, they haven't been socialized now in what would we consider right. to be a normal way because we're not getting out like we were over this past year. And so suddenly you have dogs that typically would have been, you know, 4 and 5 and 6 month old puppies that are now a year, year and a half old who don't know how to interact with people and dogs. So our business has absolutely exploded because of that, because it's just a weird time, you know, that would have probably absolutely. Been adjusted early on. And so, yeah, again, returning to work or going to a restaurant suddenly feels foreign to the dog. And we need to, again, usher through some expectations, some skills, some leadership so that they can feel comfortable, right, and secure.
Would be some of the ways that people could start socializing their dogs that, you know, as a beginning step.
Yeah, well, of course, anybody that you have in your life, if that's family or friends that you're starting to engage with, obviously, you know, being out and on the streets, you know, sometimes depending on the dog you have, you do have to be mindful of the environment. Again, you want to set them up for success. But using friends and stuff, and the reason I say friends is because sometimes you can kind of quote unquote manipulate them and say, listen,
right,
don't make a big deal about her. Like, oh my gosh, you're so cute, Aspen, right? She is terribly cute.
Yeah, which happened in the beginning. Yep.
Yeah, you have to sort of teach people and help. Please help me to teach her how to be a blind date. I'm a goofball, so that's how I refer to it, like okay. dating, right? A blind date. You are sort of normal. You're engaging. You're not too crazy. You don't try too much. You don't stay too long. You go through a blind date and then you leave. And hopefully she liked you or he liked you or whatever. And we get to another date, right? And one of the things we teach a lot is permission-based lifestyle, right? So if a friend wants to invite the dog to jump up and give them kisses, that's totally fine. But it needs to be an invitation. We don't necessarily want the dogs automatically doing that. So using some people that maybe you know to say, hey, listen, be calm at first and let's show my dog how to meet and greet in a normal circumstance and then also how to be invited for more of that intimacy or affection.
Yeah, I'd say we're good about 75% of the time. Sometimes I forget and I let it go, but we're trying to be consistent with that. It's harder when we're traveling, but
right.
Definitely makes a huge difference when we use the place.
Yeah, because everything's different. You know, there's so many other distractions in the environment that all the X factors have changed. And again, that's one of the reasons Sit Means Sit is so popular, is because we sort of have this idea that it doesn't matter if we're in Utah or at a barbecue or just us alone in the house or we went to the vet. Sit is still sit, come is still come. Right, go to your spot, still be under control until I tell you you're free and now you can goof off and engage. You know, it's that idea that we try to control. The challenge is, of course, when you change a lot of X factors, environment, right, distractions, smells, all those types of things, that it's harder, of course, to tap into their controls in those environments because they got so much coming out of them.
Right, especially when they're still young. Lots of still puppy energy.
And for a lot of people, right? A lot of people say, oh, don't worry, he's so cute, I don't mind.
Right.
So historically, we've always seen a huge group of dogs that I would say like are roughly a year old. A lot of people have gone like through a retail store or a group class type of training.
Like
right? Oh, it's a cute puppy. Well, all of a sudden, it's not as cute anymore when they're turning into full-grown dogs at a year and a half, and they're still jumping, for instance,
right?
Or pulling. Suddenly they're stronger, they're bigger. So we historically have always seen a huge group of dogs that have been through some training, but they need better training now or a better degree of control because the dog is now a dog and not a cute
puppy
little puppy
anymore.
That can get away with everything.
One of the questions, Anthony, that came in was from Randy in Utah. And he was actually asking about the change with the airlines. It used to be that people could bring their emotional support dog or quote unquote animal, you know, on the airlines. And I think now almost all of the airlines have changed to service dogs only. I know for Aspen, I had to fill out, you know, lots of documentation to show that she was truly a service dog to get her, you know, approved. But, you know, what are your thoughts about that change that's taken place? How is it affecting people? Is it a good change? People obviously took advantage of what they were calling their emotional support animal. You know, when the person in Denver tried to bring their peacock on board, I mean, it was like,
right,
oh my gosh, we've really hit a wall here. So
right.
I understand what the airlines are doing, but I think it's also affected a lot of people that truly have their dog, you know, with them for emotional support.
Yeah, it's a big topic. I will say that I don't specialize in service dogs and things in that nature. But here's one of the key things is that many people believe, well, there's a different delineation from service dog to, for instance, emotional support dog or therapy dog even. Those are considered to be different things and sort of, if you will, have different requirements and different training that goes into it. You know, unfortunately, as you just said, the, if you will, abuse of certain liberties has facilitated a necessary change because not everybody realizes the degree of control or has the degree of control they need in their dogs. And again, like we talked about, you know, being on traveling, you're talking about so many distractions and so many, if you will, risks.
There were a couple of instances where dogs actually bit somebody on the airplane.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, emotional support dogs aren't necessarily trained in the same type of format as a quote unquote true service dog is. And there's, you know, again, unfortunately, people have, you know, you can go online and get a certification.
Yes.
Right. And then further than that, it becomes the ADA question of, it's a violation for you to ask me, what's my problem, so to speak, right? So that got taken advantage of. You know, people were trying to get apartments or allow, for instance, their pit bulls in places where there are pit bull bans because he's my emotional support pit bull. And I don't have a problem with pit bulls, so don't hear me the wrong way, but that's what was happening. And then I'll, you know, further that to now engaging them in environments where they're not typical, like an airplane. And, you know, it's become a challenge. I'll tell you too, Dory, and this is difficult. I would say if I saw, and I've seen more than this, but if I saw 100 people that told me they want their dog to be an emotional support dog, I would say 90 of those dogs are totally inappropriate for that practically. And what I mean by that is they are typically emotionally charged or anxious dogs to begin with.
Okay.
And so now you've got, if you will, and this is a broad term and I don't mean it to be this way, but now you've got the anxious leading the anxious, the emotional leading the emotional. And that's not necessarily a good recipe. I understand for a lot of folks that calming, that closeness, that if you will, touch of the dogs is really important. And I recognize that. Unfortunately, that's not always how dogs operate. They don't all have
the same public. Yeah.
Right. They don't all have the right temperament to really become that. I'll use one simple example. I had a gal years ago that had PTSD. She was in the military. She got a 9-week-old puppy and she said, he's going to be my PTSD emotional support dog. And I said, I hope so. And she said, what do you mean I hope so? That's what I got him for. I said, I recognize that's what you got him for, but he's 9 weeks old. We have no idea what
his personality is going to be like. Yeah.
You're betting on some genetics. And in my life, I have two daughters who came from the same breeders and went through the same training programs and were totally different kids to begin with. So nature somehow delivered two different results. And then I had to nurture my second one, Lennox, into becoming something that we didn't see she had in the beginning. And so, you know, ultimately what happened with that particular dog is we got to about him being a year old. And he was a nice dog, but very, very social. And in that respect, didn't just stick with her, didn't really prioritize her. He prioritized socializing with everybody else. He also reacted to things that were weird. So for instance, getting in a car, he would have a total different reaction at different cars. And so he tended to be, and so now imagine, you know, she's looking for calmness and support. And he's
right.
Freaking out.
Now she's having struggles. Yeah.
And ultimately that dog, you know, was not the right fit for quote unquote emotional or PTSD support.
Jesse in Denver says, do you ever refer a client out to another trainer because of a challenging situation? And what would that be?
No, not really. We're fortunate to have a tremendous amount of experience. We have a system that really works across the board. And one of the things with Sydney said is we'll take all dogs, all ages, all breeds. That was a lot of questions were about that. What about this dog? Do you train these type of dogs or those type of dogs?
Right.
We train all dogs. Of course, they all have different temperaments and personalities and characteristics. But again, if I look at it from a foundational point of view, foundationally, fundamentally, you need to pay attention and develop skills. And when there's physical things like come or sit, it's literally a mask game. It's impossible not to learn to come or sit because we can physically show the dog over and over and over until they get it. And I don't care if it takes them, you know, 50 times or 500 times, as long as they're making effort, we're going to get there. It's when you get into their psychology that you don't know if that's ever going to change. So for instance, a sports injury, doctor says your ankle is fine, go play soccer again. And you are freaking out about your ankle, even though he told you physically you're fine, your brain is still like, I don't really trust it, doctor.
Right?
So we deal with all of that type of stuff, and knowing our experience and what else is out there in terms of the training world, it's rare that I refer dogs out unless it's something, for instance, somebody wants to hunt or do a sport.
Oh, something very specific. Sure.
Yeah. That type of stuff. We don't do agility, for instance. And so, yeah,
right.
Sure. I'll refer somebody to those types of things, but pretty much everything else we can handle. It's pretty rare. It's pretty rare. But we also do free consultations. So when we do a free consultation, if we meet and I know we're not a good fit, I'm very transparent and very honest and very open and very friendly. And I will simply tell you, this is not a good fit. And I think you should look elsewhere. So I do that. But more of that is about the owner than the dog. 80% of dog training is owner training. And when I see that maybe we're not going to be a good fit, I'll say, listen, I appreciate the time and thank you. And we'll, you know, let's move on in different directions. And that's totally, you know, I believe to be fair and in everybody's best interest, you know.
Well, I'm glad you thought that I was a good fit. Thank you. Emma wanted to know, do you have before and after videos for the dogs you've trained? And I think on your website, there's lots and lots and lots of information.
Literally thousands of videos. Our CEO, Fred Hassan, who really created a system of training and then started teaching some other people. And now, you know, again, we've got 140 locations or something. Fred does a video every single day. And a lot of those come from now across the country where there be a lot of before and after type of videos. We have always done in-person consultations. Now this last year, we've done a tremendous amount of them virtually, but as you can imagine, we're also 20 years into this. So I see a lot of people virtually who say, listen, I already know you can do the job. The internet told me that, right? Is this a good fit for me and my dog? You know,
right.
So we often will work with the dogs in their consultations and historically have even done that. So you have an opportunity to kind of see the before and after sometimes right in front of your eyes. But obviously we've done a lot of video too to support that cause.
So how do you make this fun for the owners as well? You know, for them to come in and actually, you know, do the work so that they don't feel like it's just going to be drudgery. I mean, I know I had a good time, but, you know, that was one of the questions is, you know, do you make this fun as well?
Yeah, I mean, of course, as best we can. I mean, one of the things that philosophically I have done is, again, I stopped teaching, no, stop it, don't do that, leave it, right? So that 90% of our conversations can end with, there you go, good girl, you did it, good boy, way to go, right? Because if we can get them to come, if we can get them to sit, and we can reward those behaviors, so they start to say, wait a second, you mean you're not trying to cramp my style and ruin my life? Like, no. I'm trying to teach you things that are habits that are rewardable. When you come to me, I smile and I give you some feedback and you go, wait, that's all you needed? I go, yeah, that's all I needed. Now you can go goof off again. And so, you know, it should be fun. And when we're not a no machine, it does become more fun. Of course, people enjoy seeing results right away too. So our system has been really fast at changing things and changing your ability. And when people see that, of course, right, you're encouraged. I mean, anybody you watch, you know, I went on a diet, I'm 6 days in, I lost 6 pounds. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited, right? So when you see results very quickly, it's very encouraging. And then, yeah, because of the way that we go about it, working in your psychology and the dog of telling them what we want rather than what we don't, it tends to be pretty enjoyable. Now,
yeah,
let's be honest.
I had a great time. I did the one where Aspen came and spent the day with you, you know, a couple weeks.
Yeah.
In a row. And I mean, you know, it was amazing to see the results from that, from you being able to spend time with her during the day one-on-one, and then, you know, teaching me, so to speak, in what you taught her. And I had a great time.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. You know, and of course our trainers, you know, fun, they all love dogs too. And our job is to make sure that we are becoming or being what the dog needs us to be, right? And so, yes, I've had some experience where I've had to be sort of the bad guy, the drill sergeant, you know. I've had owners straight up tell me, Anthony, I wouldn't own this dog if it wasn't for you and what your team has done. And they were difficult. We realized that. You knew with experience on how to lead them through those moments. And now we have control that we didn't used to have. So,
right.
You know, there are some moments that can be difficult because we deal with difficult dogs. You know, it's not always roses and rainbows, you know, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily rough. It's just challenging dogs. Sometimes we have to push them outside their comfort zones and get through those things. Now, that being said, most of them are just regular old dogs and it should be fun along the way. It's hard because, right, you can't explain to the dog, listen, if you just work with me for the next weeks and months, our whole life is going to be better, right? You can't give them logic and talk to them about that. When my kids didn't want to go to ski lessons, I said, listen, you guys, if you go to the ski lessons, the ski instructors know what they're looking for. They put you through the drills. They have the vocabulary I don't have, and you're going to learn faster and we'll be faster to have fun together again if you spend a little time working at this with those guys. you can explain that to the kid. You can't explain it to the dog.
Right.
So you just have to be focused that, my friend, is the light at the end of the tunnel. All this control and expectation is going to lead toward more fun, more freedom. When the dogs see that and click, they go, aha, okay, I see it. A lot of times that happens in group class where the dogs go, wait, I can socialize and have a good time?
That's right.
Yeah. You just have to come sometimes. You just have to sit sometimes. You have to lay over there while somebody else runs by because you might be on a patio at a coffee shop, right? And when a dog goes by, you can't go berserk.
Got another question. This is from Laura in Utah. And she says, at times my golden doodle gets jealous and aggressive when other dogs come close to us or comes close to me for attention. You know, how do I handle this?
So that goes back to what we talked about, an intimacy balanced out with some structure and rules and respect for kind of the expectations. Okay. And so that needs to be handled at home and everywhere we go, but creating a culture at home that says that, again, that kind of permission-based lifestyle that says, baby, I love you, but I can't spend every second with you. And there are some things that you're going to have to accept in our life. And again, no different than having kids, or in my case, employees, that I'm going to leave the shop and still expect them to play by a certain set of rules, even when I'm not here, right? So you have to develop that through training. That's one of the things we talk about is in terms of dog psychology, okay, the primal, the way the dogs work. Dogs establish who's in control by who sets boundaries. Okay, I'll say it again. Dogs establish who's in control by who sets boundaries. A mailman is a good example. Dog sees a mailman. Bark, bark, bark. Who are you? What are you doing here? You're freaking me out. I don't know you. Go away. Or, hey, you don't belong on my property. Get out of here. And it works. And it works every day. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Every time the dog goes, bark, bark, get out of here, the mailman leaves. And the dog is emboldened by that. And often then, even a dog that was kind of a scaredy cat in the beginning becomes very bold. And then when we have a breach in a door or a gate or a fence, they come face to face with this mailman who's now still standing there when for 782 days I've told you to buzz off and you haven't buzzed off yet. And they uncharacteristically can even bite. And so it's a very classic example of boundary training and what's called developing an aggression, a learned aggression. Now, not everybody's dog is aggressive. Don't hear me the wrong way. But the point is this. Dogs establish who's in control by who sets boundaries.
Okay.
So if we're not setting boundaries with our doors, our kitchens, our stairwells, our patios, our couches, our beds, those type of things in our everyday life, then we're not going to have the skills the dog needs in exceptional moments where something else comes into the environment. If my kids don't say please, thank you, and you're welcome at home, they're not going to say it at a restaurant. So you have to establish a lot of those things at home.
Makes sense. Shannon in Westminster wants to know, do you train just at your facility or do you ever do in-home training?
Because we you know, when I first started with Dave 17, 18 years ago, we were fully mobile and went everywhere. Now we have a building. Things have evolved. We do almost everything here at the building. Gives us a great opportunity to have different people, different equipment, different dogs.
It's a beautiful location. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So we do primarily everything here. And here's what made Sydney successful is, of course, if something didn't transfer from here to your house, that wouldn't help us have all these locations, right? So our system is built around making sure no matter where you are, I'm sitting sit, right? However, that being said, I have gone canoeing. I've gone hiking. I've gone to people's offices. I recently went to a girl's house who just had a baby. Her dog has been aggressive with adults and kids before. Mm. And so I made an exception and went to her house. I have no problem making that exception when it comes up, but for time's sake, we just can't necessarily do that with everybody we see. And the best part is more often than not, when people have a big concern at home and they wonder, oh my gosh, is this going to transfer to home? I tell them, listen, if I have to come to your house at some point, I will. More often than not, we never have to. They go, oh, no, everything's great. House is fine. You know, if you can control them here with 10 other dogs around, you can control them in your kitchen, usually.
Scott in Wheatridge actually asks, do you use corrective training collars such as prong collars? And when in the training process, you know, would you add a training collar?
Yeah, Scott, good job you doing your own research, which is great. We would use all different tools, okay? However, we do specialize in e-collars and remote collars. And so when you talk to 100 different trainers, you're going to find out that for the most part, you're going to land into a couple different categories, very food-based training, very leash-based training, or maybe some e-collar-based training. And for many years, people just didn't believe you could use an e-collar in the way we could. Our CEO, Fred, was just so stubborn. He believed that. You know, he looked at what hunters were doing with e-collars. He thought, oh, that's cool. They have a wireless way to communicate with their dogs.
Yeah.
For some reason, Fred's brain did not say, oh, cool, they can zap them when they're wrong. He just didn't think that. He thought, man, if you could communicate wirelessly, that would make everything a lot easier. Everybody told him he was crazy. Now we have over 140 crazy locations. And we have our own collar. So we also worked with a manufacturer to develop technology to mirror and match what the techniques were about. And so the versatility of being wireless, as you can imagine in our own life and other places, you're in Utah, I'm in Denver right now. I
mean, right.
Being wireless is a matter of efficiency, but there's limitations with leashes. There's limitations with food. We really haven't found a limitation with an e-collar. Now I will use treats and rewards, of course. I'll use leashes. If I needed a prong collar, for instance, I might do that. When you understand the appropriate use of different tools, as I mentioned earlier, a muzzle, right? I'll use a muzzle. I'll use two leashes. I'll use any of those types of things. And when you do those things appropriately, the whole idea is that you can guide the dog through a learning process until perhaps we don't need as many tools, okay? And one of the big questions is always, when my dog goes through training, will I always have to use food? Will I always have to use a leash? Will I always have to use an e-collar? The idea is, of course, that if you develop habits, hopefully the management is easy. Dory, my mom taught us to make our beds with hospital corners. My mom died a dozen years ago. I still make my bed. Now, I don't do the hospital corners, but I still get out and make my bed. It's just a habit that stuck, and I don't really require the management anymore to help with that. Most dogs develop habits. Okay, and culture, and realize, especially in a closed environment like your house, you're not using tools in the long run because you just turn to them and talk to them and they go, of course I know what you're saying and what you're doing. There's nothing else to do here. Of course I'm going to listen. It's when distractions come along that people struggle to still communicate. It's not bad dogs being bad. It's that they're distracted and into other things or excited. And that's where people struggle to maintain that focus and control. In our world, because we're wireless, you can make it more train as you live and have a higher level of control in a wider set of circumstances. I will still use e-collars with my dogs for the rest of their lives in the same way I'll still use my iPhone for the rest of my life until somebody shows me a better system.
Anna in Arvada says, how does one go about being a dog trainer?
Depends on where you look. There's lots of different ways. We have, I believe, 9 clients who now own other Sit Mean Sit locations. And across our company, we have literally dozens of clients who have become trainers because of their experience. And so some of that, Anna, is just reach out and ask for, are you hiring? And I personally don't require necessarily dog training background. I am more interested in the temperament, character, the integrity, so to speak, of the people I bring on board. They fit into our culture, and can I teach them the skills for training? Because it is in a lot of ways a skill. Yes, people have a certain inherent ability with dogs, but there's lots of different ways to get started, and there are, across the board with different trainers, some do apprenticeships and things like that. There are online schools, there are dog training schools. Sit Mean Sit has a dog training school that's specifically focused at training our franchisees. And then also, and then specifically focused on training the employees within our franchises as well. So we have kind of a certified program that trains our trainers. That's all internal within Sit Mean Sit.
A lot of the questions, kind of were around the same thing, like, how do I show my dog that I'm the boss? How do I keep my dog from chewing everything? How do I keep my dog from jumping up on everyone? And I think you covered that, a little bit, in that it's actually that consistency of setting those boundaries and consistent, training over and over and over again. And like you said, sometimes it'll take 5 times and sometimes it'll take 500 times.
Yeah, so many of those questions come down to a lot of things we've been talking about: leadership, structure, boundaries, skill building, feedback, positive reinforcement for the things you want rather than the things you don't, consistency, efficiency, being versatile. You know, all those things add up to that development, and all of those questions come along those same ideas.
So Norman asked, how do you balance the human client's needs and the animal's needs and abilities? And I think this, I mean, just in talking with people who have adopted dogs, they don't necessarily always know the right kind of dog that would work for them. Like an elderly person isn't going to want a very hyperactive dog, but somebody who does a lot of hiking is going to want more of an outdoor dog, and maybe doesn't want one with a lot of long fur. And then also just personality as far as a person and their dog. You know, what kind of advice can you give someone who might be searching for the right dog for them?
So, and it's a great question. Let's talk first about balancing owner needs with dog needs, right? That's why I keep coming back to permission-based lifestyle, because if you can balance that culture of what your human needs might look like versus the dog needs, we can usually find that balance and still have control and respect in the relationship and whatnot. But as far as finding the right dog, you have to think about your energy level, your activity, your lifestyle, your
where you live,
dwelling, where yeah. you live, your yeah. dwelling, right? Your travel schedules. I keep putting a new rule in my house: no more living things. And I'm the only man in the house. I have these women and daughters that manipulate me and keep getting more living things. So yesterday I got a call. It said, Dad, you need to bring Finn, my 5-year-old border collie, home. You need to bring Finn home because Priscilla the tortoise is missing. She's wandering the yard somewhere. And Finn knows how to find her and sniff her out. So anyhow, but I hike and ski and bike and all that. Finn bikes with me. I can take him 10 miles and he's still ready to go. So you think about those things. Sometimes people say, I'm going to get a second dog. And I say, great. Are you prepared to get a different car? Why would I need a different car? Because you can't fit two dogs plus your camping gear in that same little car you have. Oh my gosh, I hadn't thought about that. So, you know, what you're looking for in dogs, right, are some of their genetics, meaning, you know, maybe some people like, for instance, a lot of the doodles don't shed, right?
Right.
Size for your lifestyle and dwelling and cars and all that. Again, activity, veterinary needs, food needs.
Expensive.
And unfortunately, one of the downsides is poop. My daughter wants a Great Dane. I said, they poop bigger than your head. Are you prepared for that? Right. So I know that sounds silly, but I'm not kidding. Those are some of the considerations.
Yeah.
For instance, I have a client who lives downtown Denver in a high rise, and he built in his house. They are fortunate. They have a kind of a patio. He built like what you and I would look at would be a raised garden. It's actually an AstroTurf elimination area for his dog to go to the bathroom because he's 6 stories up and it's a little dog and he didn't want to keep going out of the building
up and down the stairs
to go to the bathroom.
Right. Oh, very
right.
Cool.
Now, if you get a Great Pyrenees and build that same management system on your patio, you have a different thing than you did with your Bichon.
Yep. Wow. So
that's, you think about drive. You think about drive as well. Okay. So that's a big one. One of the dogs, there's a dog called the Belgian Malinois. They're very popular with military and police. They have now been in the movies. They were part of the Navy SEAL team that went and got Osama bin Laden. And they're beautiful. They're beautiful. And then people get them and think, oh my gosh, that's a beautiful dog. I'm going to get one. I'm going to keep them in my apartment. That's a terrible, terrible idea.
Because they're very active.
Like keeping an alligator in your apartment.
Right.
These are working dogs. Working right. dogs that will find something to work on. And if you don't give them the right amount of work, they're going to find it in bad places. You know, and so it is. And that it comes to genetics and drive. So those are some of the things you really need to look for. One of the things I do suggest, obviously, with somebody that, unless you have a specific need of a specific breed, okay, because of their characteristics. Shelters are full of great dogs. Rescues are full of great dogs. They get put in those places for a variety of silly reasons. And some of those are just a lack of training and direction.
Yes.
And so, yes. You know, you can go in, and when you get into a dog that is 9 or 10 months to like a year and a half, 2 years, their temperaments are often pretty developed. The personalities are pretty developed. You know a lot better what you have at that point than if you even got a 9-week-old puppy. You're betting a 9-week-old puppy would be something. I'm sure my mom had visions of me being a doctor like you, right? But that didn't happen, right? So you never know what you're going to get with a little baby.
Never know. Beth asked, how do you ensure the safety of the dogs who stay with you?
Obviously, the taking care of the dogs is our primary concern. So the building and facility and doorways and fencing and kennels and all these different protocols are in place to, number one, keep the dogs in our care safe. Number two, keep my trainers safe. Number three, keep the other clients in the building safe. And then number four, the community on the other side of our fences safe. So we have all sorts of protocols to go through with those type of things that protect and keep everybody safe and sort of what we call snout to tail checks on the dogs, make sure they're healthy and all that. I actually have people on my staff that don't train dogs. They're here for kennel and feeding and enrichment. So the dogs have some downtime with somebody that does not necessarily have expectations, camp or a boot camp or something. A lot of us, the trainers, have expectations, right? Dogs go, oh golly, he's got expectations.
That means
I've got to, you know, put my suit on the right way and stand up the right way and walk the right way and all this kind of stuff. I have a couple people on my staff that don't require that of the dogs. They are there for enrichment and downtime for the dogs, which in my mind is really, really important. We all need that.
Well, we didn't get through all of our questions. We're going to absolutely have to have you come back again, Anthony. I want to make sure that people do know how to reach you, though. Your website, your phone number, your location, the best way to find out where Sit Means Sit is located.
Sure. The easiest, best thing to do, because you do have a wide audience, is just go to sitmeansit.com. You can type in your zip code, and it will pop up and tell you the closest location.
Okay.
All of the cities, the major cities, for instance, instead of just typing in sitmeansit.com, you could type in denver.sitmeansit.com, cleveland.sitmeansit.com. So you could find it either way. And all of our locations primarily offer a free consultation,
yep.
An opportunity to get to know one another and see if it's a good fit. Many of them will invite you in to do that. Obviously, we could do those things virtually as well. But that way we can see what's a good fit for you and the dog, what program might be the best fit. Many of us offer a variety of choices, obviously. Each individual location is an individual owner for the most part. And so we try to play well together, even when you move and stuff like that. But I may not offer the same things they do in Massachusetts.
Well, for our local people, though, what's the best way for them to reach you there in Wheat Ridge?
Sure. Denver.sitmeansit.com. Or, of course, you could call us directly. That's 303-422-DOGS.
Okay.
303-422-DOGS. That's 3647. If you end on our website, you can fill out a form. It goes automatically into our database. And April is our schedule coordinator, and she's fantastic. And she will automatically get a hold of you.
And you could
email us, denver@sitmeansit, too.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm definitely going to be in touch with you and have you back on the show again. I think there's just, you know, a lot of questions. I'm glad things are so busy for you. And Aspen and I will look forward to seeing you soon for a tune-up.
I'll look forward to that, too. Thanks so much. I appreciate you having us.
Sure. I want to let everybody know that next week we're going to have Russell Beebe on. He is the founder of Wellness Seekers Unlimited. And Russell's going to actually talk about being overwhelmed and burned out in the mental health field. And that certainly seems to be a topic that a lot of people are concerned about and dealing with, especially after, you know, a year plus of working with COVID in the mental health field. And he's got some great information to share. I want to leave you today with a saying, and I have to say, I don't know who this came from, but it absolutely fits how my week has been here in Utah. It says, you'll be calm the day you learn to sit alone and do nothing. And I actually have had the opportunity to do that this last week. I can't remember the last time I've been able to actually do that. So I hope you all get an opportunity as well to have some calmness in your life and to sit alone for a while and do nothing. I'll look forward to seeing you next week. I'll be back in Colorado. Thanks everyone for being here today. Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.